The headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. The world of business, big and small, is moving ever faster. This is particularly true for black businesses. And today there are black entrepreneurs who are involved in all aspects of business, even some that we could not have even dreamed about a generation ago. Well, tonight we're going back to the future to discuss how modern black businesses can learn from the lessons of the past. My guest is Dr. William Picard. He is author of The Entrepreneurial Spirits of Yesterday, a celebration of 100 African-American businesses and communities from 1850 to 1950. Lines are open if you have a comment or question about our topic tonight at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Dr. Picard, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
I am more than happy to be with you, Harold.
Well, thank you so much. Before we even get into the book and the topic, give me kind of the Cliff Notes version of your business experiences. You've got a laundry list of stuff that you've done.
Well, to give it to you, first of all, you must believe in God. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, you must believe in black people. I was born in LaGrange, Georgia. Grew up in that booming city of Flint, Michigan. Wanted to be a social worker because of the black thing that I was involved with my family. Was able to go to college. Was able to finish the University of Michigan with a master's in social work in the 60s. Wanted to work for the NAACP, and I wound up in Cleveland, Ohio. And while in Cleveland, we launched a boycott in 1968 against the McDonald's company. It was rough, it was tough, but we shut McDonald's down in the city of Cleveland, Ohio in 1968-67. It was an economic boycott that worked. Out of that, two black men went to prison, one black man died, and some of us left town. I left town to go to Ohio State to get a doctorate. And while working on my doctorate, I was fortunate enough to be offered a McDonald's restaurant in Detroit, Michigan, which we opened in 1971. And from McDonald's, God stepped in, and I went from manufacturing automobiles to McDonald's, and then from that to MGM Casinos. And from that, I'm very proud. Today, we own 5 black-owned newspapers in Detroit, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and the city of Atlanta. So my life has been a dream. My life has been perfect. But it's come off the backs of black people who made a way out of no way and who paid the ultimate price so that we could have opportunities in the 1980s and the 1970s and today.
How would you describe the spirit of entrepreneurship? What is the secret sauce for that? Is it the same now as it has been historically for black folks?
Well, I think it is very much the same and yet different. In 1880, if you had that yearn, that spirit of entrepreneurship, you had a ready-built market because it was separate, black and white. May I give you an example? In 1889, there were a group of black men in Memphis, Tennessee, which is right outside of Memphis, by the way. There's an area called the Curve. In 1889, a group of black men, primarily men who worked in the post office, decided to open a grocery store in an area called the Curve in Memphis, Tennessee. And these men, not only did they open up a grocery store, but they began to put a white grocery store nearby out of business. The lead brother was Robert Moss, M-O-S-S. In 1889, they opened up. In 1891, that was a race riot. The 3 black participating owners were taken out of jail in the middle of the night and killed because Barnett, the white man, whose business was affected, created a hysteria that the black community was up in arms. these three men were taken to jail, taken out of jail at 3 a.m. in the morning, and assassinated. Ida B. Wells was a friend of Mr. Moss, and she began to write the stories about Memphis and the black men in the grocery store. So even though we were simply going into business, trying to do the American dream, because one white man's business was damaged, three black men died. But out of that, 7,000 black families left Memphis, Tennessee in 1891-92 and relocated primarily to Oklahoma.
When you think about those horrific challenges, and certainly I don't call them challenges and use the term lightly, but when you talk about, you know, modern entrepreneurs, even those that have been successful, are there still those same kinds of racial challenges?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. You find the wig shops that are everywhere in our community, owned by people who are basically able to speak English. Without a doubt, there have been individual cases where brothers would try to open wig shops and nail shops, and that would be mysterious fires in different communities. So the same kind of thing goes on, of course, but now it's more related to pricing. You can't get the same quality of product, and those kind of things play out globally, because oftentimes those people are from foreign countries and they have a cartel that are able to get them the products they need to sell us in our community. I wish and I pray that one day our community rise up and say, no, I don't need a wig that bad. I don't need to get my nails done that bad. There are other ways to do this.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. My guest is Dr. William Picard. He is author of the new book, The Entrepreneurial Spirits of Yesterday, a celebration of 100 African-American businesses and communities from 1850 to 1950. Piggybacking on that last point, though, Dr. Picard, why not? Why should black folks run from wigs and getting their nails done? Why can't they instead establish a business foothold in, for example, the beauty market and fight back?
Well, obviously, there are some communities where we have been fighting back and fighting back very successful. But the challenge oftentimes is a free marketplace. If you happen to be from Korea and you can go back to the Korean government and you can cut deals there with other manufacturers to bring product into Detroit below market. So when you sell your product for $8.99 and I have to price mine at $12.99, that's a huge difference for our community to absorb. And that is a part of what happens every day.
And looking at these, you know, 100 businesses, and certainly there have been some, you know, some very prominent African Americans who have had great businesses, and they really kind of sit at the top of the top of the pile. When you know the Madam C.J. Walkers and others, but who are some of the people that did exceptionally well, but whose names never really rose to the top?
That's a great question. That's a great question, brother. Well, you know, I remember now a lot of my first book was called Millionaire Moves, and we sold about 10,000 copies, primarily to black college students and black people. But some of the examples of the 100 that we have in the new book are just amazing. May I give you for in a moment, Boley, Oklahoma. Oklahoma at one time had 34 all-black towns. Boley, Oklahoma was the largest of the 34. Now, some of your listeners are almost as old as I am, and they might have heard of a gangster, a real gangster named Pretty Boy Floyd. Mm-hmm. Pretty Boy Floyd was notorious for robbing banks and trains. Someone once said, "Pretty Boy, why do you always rob banks?" He said, "Because that's where the money is." So the story goes, in 1931, they decide to go to Boley, Oklahoma, an all-black town in 1931, and they had a bank. And the story goes that Pretty Boy Floyd said, "Hey, we better not hit that bank. Those black people got all kinds of guns, and I just don't think we should do this." So one of the guys said, guess what, pretty boy, you're getting a little older, you're too conservative, we're going to take it down. So they ride in to Boley, Oklahoma, to the Farmers and Mechanics Bank in 1931. And they get there and they said, listen, it's a hold up. Don't do anything crazy. Nobody will get hurt. Just give us some money. The bank president was named Mr. D.R. Turner, T-U-R-N-E-R. He said, sir, just give us the money and nobody will get hurt. Do not hit the alarm. This is a town of 4,000 black people in Boley, Oklahoma, 1931. Mr. Turner hit the alarm. He says, I told you not to do that. Why did you do it? He said, because I hit it. Bam! He killed Mr. Turner on sight. The other black man who was hiding near the vault picked up his rifle, which they kept. He shot Pretty Boy's guy and killed him. Long story short, black people heard the alarm. Black people ran to the bank. The three people that came to rob the Boley, Oklahoma Black Bank that day all died. Mr. Turner did lose his life protecting black folks' money. There was a town of 4,000. When they buried him, 3,000 people showed up. So that was one of those incidents where your grandmother tell you, don't mess with black folks' money, son. Don't do that. And Pretty Boy Floyd always threatened to come back, but he never did.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. I'm talking to Dr. William Picard. He is the author of The Entrepreneurial Spirits of Yesterday, a celebration of 100 African-American businesses and communities from 1850 to 1950. Oba, calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling, Oba. What's on your mind?
Hey, first I want to say, great show. Always listen to you. This is an excellent topic. Excellent topic. Me being a you know, a child of an entrepreneur, and I'm already raising my son and my daughters, my daughter and my sons to be entrepreneurs. It was first great to hear these stories. I got to get this book on that. But my question is, we have a lot of, you know, black millionaires, you know, in sports or other, you know, ways of them making money, but can you speak on the difficulty of us being able to control, like, some of these natural resources, like gas, water, electricity, or even, you know, the internet, which prevents us from making, like, mega millions and billions?
Go right ahead. Well, obviously, the things you made reference to, like oil, water, and gas, the Indians had it all, and you see what happened to them.
Right.
But there are blacks today who are very, like last night we had a thing at the Mahogany Bookstore, and a brother came out from a group called Blacks in Energy. And these brothers and sisters have been in business for 40 plus years trying to steer blacks into careers in energy and what have you. I was out in Oklahoma recently and Texas, and there are some blacks who own major gas station outlets. But if you talk about distribution, we're involved. But if you're talking about the source of the oil and the petroleum, the brothers in Nigeria probably have one of the best holds on that in the world. And there has been a black family in Oklahoma, the Simmons. You ought to Google them, brother. The Simmons is a black family. They've been in Oklahoma since the 1890s, and they are big in the oil business. And they were the ones in the 1960s that went to Nigeria to cut some deals for major oil companies, and they are very prevalent in the petroleum distribution business.
Oh, well, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. One of the things that has been happening recently that I think has some really expansive historical references. We just earlier this week, we did a program about medical marijuana and the difficulty that black businesses are having in the state of Maryland, as well as in other parts of the country, getting into that, you know, that business, the legal marijuana business, whether it's medical or in some parts of the country, recreational marijuana. This seems to be a repeat in some cases of what happened after prohibition. Talk to me about the parallel.
Well, you know, Michigan, we have legal marijuana. It was on the ballot recently, statewide, and it passed. I happen to live in the city of Detroit. I've been there for some 50-odd years, from McDonald's to MGM Casino to United. I've been very, very blessed. I voted against it because there were no provisions. There was no allocation that X percent of the outlets, retail outlets, even in the city of Detroit, in my opinion, should be set aside for local residents. If the local residents happen to be Arab, that's them. If they happen to be black, that's them. Because there was no provision for that, I voted against it. So now what do you have? The same people that own the beer and wine store in my community, next door they got a marijuana shop. And again, we have been locked out. And I think some of that, of course, plays into the political scene. And unfortunately, our black legislators, at least in the state of Michigan, in my opinion, were not as aggressive as they should have been. The state of Ohio was different. They had provisions that blacks and women must be included. And some blacks did prevail in the state of Ohio.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about black businesses, kind of a back to the future, looking at the impact of historically successful black businesses and what modern entrepreneurs can learn from that. Aisha, quickly, calling from Virginia, what's on your mind? Aisha, quickly, what's on your mind?
I'm actually calling because I am a beauty supply store owner in Alexandria, Virginia. And I was listening to your discussion and the talk about how Asians control the market, and there's some truth behind that. But we also have a variety of black-owned beauty supply stores across the country, and one of our biggest struggles is just getting support from the community and how we find these stores and give them our support and shop them more often. And that's something that we should talk more about in our community, is how we support our black businesses so that we can thrive and grow, especially in the market that we dominate as far as consumers.
Aisha, can you hold on? I'll let you finish your point, and I'll also let Dr. Picard respond to your comment. But I need to take a break, so stay with us. Do not hang up. You will be able to hear the program. Also, Renee calling from Silver Spring, we're also going to talk to you, so please do not hang up. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on 96.3 WHUR. But this conversation continues on Sirius XM, Channel 141, in just a few seconds. Again, the number 202-319-7810. We'll be back in a moment.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we're going back to the future to discuss how modern black businesses can learn from the lessons of the past. My guest is Dr. William Picard. He is the author of The Entrepreneurial Spirits of Yesterday, a celebration of 100 African-American businesses and communities from 1850 to 1950. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. 10. We had Aisha on the phone. Can you respond to what she was saying?
Sure.
I think she really put a fine point on the other side of businesses, specifically black business and customer support.
Well, I think not only in the beauty business, but in all facets of our retail experience, we have to find ways to drive our community consciously and intentionally into our businesses. And whether you like it or not, the black church is probably one of the most powerful forces in our community. Now, there are some ministers that you should not waste your time talking with about these things. But there's a cadre. There's a cadre of ministers who get it. And I would make sure that when you band together with other people in your industry, whether it's beauty supply or fast food or whatever, if you can get those churches to support you and get their membership involved, I think you can see an uptick in your business. And I would not be reluctant to do what retailers always do. You slash prices, you put on specials, and you give deals. I know in our experience in Detroit with McDonald's, when we went to McDonald's in 1971, McDonald's Corporation would not advertise on black radio stations because you were not in the Amazon or some rating and you weren't in the book. So they were
in Arbitron. Exactly.
They
yes.
would not buy black radio. So you know what we did? We decided that every Thursday we would have a black disc jockey come to our restaurant and broadcast, and we'd give a certain proceed of that to the station and the jock and to a nonprofit. And that's how we were able to penetrate the black community as McDonald's. So the church can be a powerful mechanism. There are other community groups in different cities that have the same kind of following. So, yes, you operate a great business, but sometimes you got to go out of your comfort zone and go talk to people in our community who demand and command large followings to support your business.
One other thing, and this goes back to what Aisha was talking about. In right now, consumers as a whole, black consumers and everyone else, they're being told to negotiate for the best price, mm-hmm. for additional services for the prices that mm-hmm. are offered. But then black entrepreneurs often say, why should I negotiate or cut my prices when there is the assumption that black consumers will not ask white businesses to do the same? Your thoughts about that?
Well, obviously, that is a reasonable rationalization. But my answer is very simple. I have a business to operate. And whatever I have to do with customer A, B, and C to get them in my door and to make that transaction, I'm going to do it. Sometimes I call it front loading. You got to give up something to get something. When you go to McDonald's, as an example, to buy one, get one free, I'm hoping I'll make money because I want you to buy that extra large drink. So there's always caveats to get people to come into your business, because if they don't come in, you don't have a good shot of getting them as a customer, let alone retaining them as a customer.
Aisha, thank you for your thoughtful contribution to the conversation. I appreciate it. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Renee, calling from Silver Spring. Hey, yeah. Renee, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I wanted to speak a little bit about the where our money is in terms of with the older parts of our community and how to get them to start feeling more comfortable with investing in entrepreneurship, like within their families. Because oftentimes, even with our president, you know, he was able to get, you know, seed money for his business through his dad. But even though we may have, and not to say that everybody has it available, but amongst the seniors and stuff who do have those kinds of monies available, oftentimes they're extremely reluctant. And part of me thinks that it has, that's at least in part to that scene in Raisin in the Sun, where Sidney Poitier loses all that woman's money. I feel like that's kind of what, you know, these parents and grandparents see to themselves when, you know, when their son or daughter comes to them with a good business idea.
Well, I suspect trust is an important variable. I suspect your previous success in managing and handle business affairs enters into it. But I do think you are correct about one major thing, that the elders in our community, oftentimes the seniors in our community, have the most amount of savings. And how they go about investing that, of course, is a very challenging process. But there are some families that literally have clubs called investment clubs. And each person each month gives $5 or $10 into this investment club to help them go out and do a big deal. The Jamaicans do this very frequently. The brothers and sisters from Nigeria have their family clubs. A lot of the Caribbean families get together consciously, and they pool their money on a monthly basis to be able to go out and have another family leverage that money. And they stay together for years doing that and creating businesses.
Mm. So why is it that, black folks that come from outside of the continental U.S., for example, seem to have perfected this when those who have been here for generations are still working on that, to put it mildly?
That's a profound question. And it is no secret that Caribbean blacks go into business much more frequently than American blacks. I think some of that is they have seen the necessity and the importance of working together. But I think there's another variable. I think our brothers who come from the Caribbean and Africa fully understand that the government ain't gonna save us, and the only people gonna save us is us, and therefore they band together better and more often than we do.
Thank you so much for your phone call, Renee. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Talk to me about some of the more, historically, some of the more non-traditional businesses that a lot of folks don't know about. Obviously, funeral homes, banks, medical professionals, doctors, and dentists, as well as lawyers. But what other kinds of businesses, historically, may we not always be familiar with?
Well, there's a gentleman named Horace L. King. And I always tell black folks to go Google me, because they said, "Pick, you're just talking out your neck." Horace L. King, K-I-N-G. He's known in the books as the bridge builder. Born a slave in 1809 in South Carolina. His master was a bridge builder. And by the grace of God, this young man had a knack for engineering and building bridges. I won't bore you with all the things he accomplished, but his master sent him to Birmingham, Alabama, in 1831, 1832, when Birmingham was booming. He went there, made tons of money for his master. And his master petitioned the state of Alabama for his freedom. They gave this black man his freedom. He left Birmingham, Alabama, moved to what is now Phoenix, Alabama, and went in business. His company was called Horace L. King and Sons Construction. Now, he did this before the Civil War. So when the Civil War broke out, the Confederates said, "Hey, Horace, come back. Help us repair these bridges that the Yankees are knocking down." And the Yankees are saying, "Hey, Horace, come tell us where the bridges." So Brother Man just disappeared.
I would imagine so.
Brother Man disappeared. And this is kind of personal, because in the latter years of his life, Horace L. King and his sons moved to a little town in Georgia called LaGrange, Georgia. I was born in LaGrange, Georgia. He built a subdivision in LaGrange, Georgia called King Street. I was born at 213 King Street in LaGrange, Georgia. He passed away in 1882, and his son became a builder and a developer, not only in LaGrange in West Georgia, but even up in Atlanta. He built the 1895 Cotton Exposition Negro Building, where Booker T. Washington made the famous speech, "Drop your bucket where you are." That building for the Negroes was built by Horace L. King's son. So we've been doing things, man, for years. But again, it was not in our books, because I think sometimes they didn't want us to know the kinds of things that we have accomplished as a people.
For 20th century black entrepreneurs, who really sticks out to you? Throw out some names that...
Robert F. Smith, the billionaire brother. with Vista Industries. My God,
the one who paid off the loans for the students at Morehouse.
Yeah.
A lot of folks wanted to go to Morehouse now.
The Russell family down in Atlanta, third generation engineering, construction, and building companies. So we have these examples, but our challenge has been historically, we have a difficult time going from the first generation to the second generation to the third generation.
Why is that?
Well, it's difficult in any family, regardless of ethnicity, because when you're 18 years of age and you grow up in a community where you have all the stuff you need, you just think this happened magically. You don't understand the struggle that your grandfather and father went through. And so oftentimes, most companies do not get to the third generation that are family-owned companies. But we have some that have been very successful in that regard. And if you go to different cities, you'll see different success variables. In Detroit, we have a family there that's been in the car business now for three generations as automobile dealers. But again, that's a little bit unusual. But we have these pockets of success, but we don't have the global success where we're celebrated in the mass media. Now, if you pick up black-owned newspapers, they will tell you about success stories in St. Louis. They will tell you about success stories in Atlanta. But there's no national effort, seemingly, to publicize some of these companies.
What, in your opinion, is the most difficult business for our black entrepreneurs to get into now? What is the new frontier that they're struggling with?
Oh, technology is the new frontier. And the good news is it doesn't require a lot of money oftentimes. And the good news is there's not as many barriers. But it requires thinking. It requires a lot of ability to just visualize where you want to go in life, what you want to be with, and what you want to do with. The internet is the best example in the world. The barriers there are not as great as, for an example, construction is a tremendous business. But the amount of capital and what it takes to become a major construction firm, to build a Marriott hotel or to build a major stadium, there are a lot of hurdles there. But technology has eliminated some of those barriers. And we do have a cadre of young blacks now who are preparing themselves for technology.
Mm-hmm. What part do you think philanthropy can play in building generational business wealth? Because you have some philanthropic pursuits yourself.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we were brought into the supply chain in Detroit as automobile suppliers for General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, one of the reasons they said point blank, we're going to create very successful large businesses, and we expect you guys to reinvest and you ladies to reinvest in your community. That was it. But sad to say, before the meltdown in 2010 and 2011 and 2009, we had probably 50 multi-million dollar suppliers automotively in Detroit. With globalization today, we probably have less than 10 of us who are still standing. So the marketplace will make a punk out of you, brother, because when you now have to be able to supply people in Australia, Brazil, Detroit, and Europe, it's a different game.
Before, infrastructure.
Yeah, before, you probably supplied a plant in Detroit and maybe one in Toledo. That won't cut it no more. You must be able to supply this part wherever Toyota is building a car. And that could be in five different places around the world.
We do have some high-profile entrepreneurs, the Oprah Winfrey's, the Tyler Perry's, and the like. But again, for somebody such as yourself who may have, as my mother would say, a couple of quarters to invest, how do you know what is a good idea, particularly if it is a new idea?
Well, you know, people always say, well, Pickard, you know, your doctor is in social work. how'd you stumble in the business? Well, there's God. But one thing I do, I read every day, all day. I look for the trends. What are the things that are going to happen? For an example, anyone in America today that doesn't understand that health care is going to be a booming business for the next 3 or 4 decades, something is wrong with it. And for anyone who doesn't understand that the aspect of senior citizen and senior citizen living and caring for seniors, it is a bonanza. So I read a lot, but at the end of the day, when I have opportunities that come to me, I tell people, I don't bet on the horse. I don't bet on the business. I bet on the jockey. Who's going to manage the business? How bad does he want to be successful? How bad does she want to be successful? You know, a horse eat grass. A horse eat anything. A jockey want filet mignon, Dover sole. I bet on the jockey. I don't bet on the horse.
Mm-hmm. When you look back at some of the successes and even failures, because I'm sure that there have been some things that you did not do well.
Big time.
What is the lesson? What is the lesson that you learned that you would be willing to be transparent and pass on to someone who wants to follow in your shoes?
Well, I have a book that's out today called Millionaire Moves. Mm-hmm. And the title is 7 Proven Principles of Entrepreneurship. What are those principles in entrepreneurship that you live and die by? Now, I have 7. One of those is vision and attitude. What is your vision? What do you really want to be? How do you see yourself? What will happen when you become successful? Another one of my principles is relationships. And almost every business I've ever gone into or was invested in, somebody gave me a tip. Somebody knew somebody that knew me and put me in that business. Relationships are critical because in this game, everyone is qualified, basically. But who gets the nod to do this or to do that? Another one of my principles that I live and die by is failure. And there's no one that's failed more than Bill Pickard. And my quote is very simple. Failure is never fatal, and success is never final. I heard Tyler Perry say the other morning on the Tom Jones Show. Tom said, "Hey, Tyler, what's up?" He said, "Man, I got to go to work. I got rent to pay." Mm-hmm. It never stops, bro. I've been very, very blessed in life. But I'm hustling every day. I'm out here every day trying to find something to make something different. And by the way, I tell my friends, I'm not a very bright brother. I didn't go to Harvard or Howard or any of the Morehouse colleges.
Which you could have, but
I didn't.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't get in.
Yes.
And if I had gotten in, I probably would have been put out too early. But I tell people there's a big difference between talent and hustle. And one thing I know about hustle will always be talent if talent doesn't hustle. Talk to me.
You have, you know, been in the various stages of the limelight, I'm sure. But how, if at all, has pop culture affected your success and, by extension, the successes of the modern entrepreneur? We had a, and this is why I ask. We had a caller who talked about sports figures. And the like, sports figures, football, baseball, basketball, and the like, tennis, black sports figures have made more money historically over the past 10 years than in all the years combined, I would argue. And yet, because they are so high profile, does their popularity get in the way of the kind of work that you would like to see other young black entrepreneurs do? Is that a distraction?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a distraction, but you ought to ask yourself, step back and ask yourself.
How's your hook shot?
How all the people in the NBA, yeah. Where are they 6 years after they shoot their last shot? Where are they in life? Where are they financially? You know the statistic. recently, 85% of the NBA based foot basketball players are in bankruptcy 72 months after they take the last shot. Now, I think the present group of guys, James, Curry, and others, will change that. But don't get fooled by the hype, bro, man. You got to make a lot of money in your life to last you for 50 years. And you shooting that ball and you got a lot of accolades. But if you don't prepare and use your money wisely, you'll be broker than Rayman in 8 years.
And with that said, so I'm sure that this isn't the first time that you've seen it, and it doesn't have to be sports figures. There could be people in business.
Entertainment.
Yeah, entertainment. What's missing? What
business,
aren't they getting?
Relationships. For an example, it's no secret that most sports people have an agent. You read periodically where an agent stole $50 million from somebody. It's your relationship. What are you doing when you're not in the bar? Are you in the club throwing money in the air? Or are you somewhere reading a book about investment? I'm very proud when I hear about guys like Durant and others who are making major investments in technology. I hear there's a large number of black men who invested in a new pizza franchise that where they cook the pizza in 4 or 5 minutes. Now, some of that's going to work. Some of it's not going to work. But I guarantee you, making money in America is easier than keeping it.
But you have a degree in social work, so maybe you can talk about the difference between cultures, because we've seen, let's take the NFL, for example. I live in Baltimore, so if you go to M&T Bank Stadium and you watch the members of the NFL pull up, okay, you will see that a lion's share of the black football players are driving Maseratis and they are driving Ferraris, but the white football players are driving pickup trucks.
Yep.
Nice pickup trucks.
Yeah.
But they're still driving pickup trucks. What's being missed here?
Having an uncle back home, having a coach from high school, having somebody in your life say, "Son, this ain't gonna last forever." And that was recently a black athlete. I don't know his name. He had signed a big contract. He was coming out of the practice facility. He was thinking about going to buy him a very expensive car. And the owner pulled up in an 8-year-old Chevy Silverado truck.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "That's it. I'm putting my money in the bank, and I'm going to drive me an old truck until I'm ready to retire." So this is sometimes delayed gratification. But, you know, a lot of it is, I spent all my life not having nothing, and now that I got this money, I'm going to make it rain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, rain doesn't last forever, brother, not even 40 days.
And maybe when it stops falling, things get dry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how about that? Some final, I've got about 5 minutes here. When you kind of look back at this 100 year history, what is the thing that has struck you and surprised you the most about black entrepreneurs?
Without a doubt, how did these black folks create all of this money, wealth? How did they hire black people when the average white bank would not even loan them money? How did Mr. A.G. Gaskin down in Birmingham, Alabama in 1950 keep his business afloat?
The insurance magnate.
The insurance guy.
Yeah.
The motel guy. The secretary of training guy. He had all these different businesses. But they were self-financed primarily. And when they are self-financed, what does that tell you? You got to conserve more money because you don't have a bank to loan you money to work off of. That's what amazes me. That they didn't have a bank to go borrow money from and pay them back over 3, 6, 8, 10 years. They were their own bankers. And by the grace of God, in some cases, we had number men or policy men in our community who did and could loan black people money to go into business or for a family emergency or what have you.
And let's be clear, you talk about numbers men, for example, you know, we are talking about those who ran numbers, who participated in the illicit gambling trade in the black community.
And they were very successful. The Jones brothers out of Chicago were making $25 million a year. They had homes all over the world. They had businesses all over Chicago. But yet, when Al Capone and his boys came in, they gave the Jones family a choice. Either stay here and fight it out, or go to Mexico and get your money every month. You can Google it. The Jones brothers went to Mexico. But they had an unbelievable lifestyle. They did so much for black people. They gave money to Howard, by the way. Ed Jones came to Howard as a student wanting to go into pre-med. He dropped out, became a Pullman porter, and decided, I'm going back to Chicago and getting the numbers business. And he was a multi-millionaire. And Al Capone did not kill him because he and his brothers went to Mexico.
Mm-hmm. And we're even seeing some of, when you talk about numbers, but legitimate numbers, finance, like the Eddie Browns, Eddie and Sylvia Brown, mm-hmm. in Baltimore, now expanding into hospitality and, mm-hmm. and hotels mm-hmm. and not just retirement investment and the like. Mm-hmm. And so that's an interesting way to see how they are even growing their business. And of course, they are cultural icons in Baltimore, contributing to things like the Soulful Symphony and the like. I've got 1 minute left. You're doing some work here at Howard. What are you talking about?
Well, we spent a great day at Howard with your outstanding dean of the School of Business, Dr. Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
And we're discussing the possibility in January, the spring semester, of having a course to talk about the black businesses that exist in America from 1850 to 1950. We want to help black students understand you have a rich history. Whether you go into business or not, you need to know about these black men and women who made a way out of no way. Because when you go to work for KPMG or when you go to work for Google and they're getting on your last nerve, go in a corner and think about Madam C.J. Walker. Go in a corner and think about Horace L. King and what they had to endure. And I believe this will help you to survive those moments.
Dr. William Picard, thank you so much for sharing this information with us about your book and enlightening us. I really appreciate it. And for those who are interested in finding the book, where can they find it?
Well, we're with Amazon.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, there you go. We'll be posting that a link to your book on our website on WHUR.com. And again, thank you so much.
Thank you. That is
The Daily Drum on SiriusXM, Channel 141 for this Wednesday, October 23rd. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.